Wolf Hall, Disc 6.
Chapter 3. Make or Mar. All Hallows, 1529. Halloween. The world's edge seeps and bleeds. This is the time when the tally keepers of purgatory, its clerks and jailers, listen in to the living who are praying for the dead. At this time of year, with their parish, he and Liz would keep vigil. They would pray for Henry Wicks, her father, for Liz's dead husband, Thomas Williams, for Walter Cromwell, and for distant cousins, for half-forgotten names, long-dead half-sisters and lost stepchildren. Last night he kept the vigil alone. He lay awake, wishing Liz back, waiting for her to come and lie beside him. It's true he is at Esher with the Cardinal, not at home at the Austin Friars. But, he thought, she'll know how to find me. She'll look for the Cardinal, drawn through the space between worlds by incense and candlelight. Wherever the Cardinal is, I will be. At some point he must have slept. When daylight came, the room felt so empty. It was empty even of him. All Hallows Day. Grief comes in waves. Now it threatens to capsize him. He doesn't believe that the dead come back. But that doesn't stop him from feeling the brush of their fingertips, wingtips against his shoulder. Since last night, there have been less individual forms and faces than a solid, aggregated mass, their flesh slapping and jostling together, the texture dense like sea creatures, their faces sick with an undersea sheen. Now he stands in a window embrasure, Liz's prayer book in hand. His daughter Grace liked to look at it, and today he can feel the imprint of her small fingers under his own. These are Our Lady's prayers for the canonical hours, the pages illuminated by a dove, a vase of lilies. The office is matins, and Mary kneels on a floor of checkered tiles. The angel greets her, and the words of his greeting are written on a scroll which unfurls from his clasped hands as if his palms are speaking. His wings are coloured, heaven blue. He turns the page. The office is Lord's. Here is a picture of the visitation. Mary, with her neat little belly, is greeted by her pregnant cousin, St. Elizabeth. Their foreheads are high, their brows plucked, and they look surprised, as indeed they must be. One of them is a virgin, the other advanced in years. Spring flowers grow at their feet, and each of them wears an airy crown made of gilt wires as fine as blonde hairs. He turns a page. Grace, silent and small, turns the page with him. The office is prime. The picture is the Nativity. A tiny white Jesus lies in the folds of his mother's cloak. The office is sext. The Magi proffer jewelled cups. Behind them is a city on a hill. A city in Italy, with its bell tower, its view of rising ground and its misty line of trees. The office is known. Joseph carries a basket of doves to the temple. The office is Vespers. A dagger sent by Herod makes a neat hole in a shocked infant. A woman throws up her hands in protest, or prayer, her eloquent, helpless palms. The infant corpse scatters three drops of blood, each one shaped like a tear. Each bloody tear is a precise vermilion. He looks up. Like an after-image, the form of the tears swims in his eyes. The picture blurs. He blinks. Someone is walking towards him. It is George Cavendish. His hands washed together. His face is a mask of concern. "Let him not speak to me," he prays. "Let George pass on."
"Master Cromwell," he says, "I believe you are crying. What is this? Is there bad news about our master?"
He tries to close Liz's book, but Cavendish reaches out for it.
"Ah, you are praying."
He looks amazed. Cavendish cannot see his daughter's fingers touching the page, or his wife's hands holding the book. George simply looks at the pictures upside down. He takes a deep breath and says, "Thomas?" "I'm crying for myself," he says. "I'm going to lose everything. Everything I've worked for all my life, because I will go down with the Cardinal. No, George, don't interrupt me. Because I have done what he asked me to do, and been his friend, and the man at his right hand. If I had stuck to my work in the city instead of hurtling about the countryside making enemies, I'd be a rich man, and you, George, I'd be inviting you out to my new country house and asking your advice on furniture and flower beds. But look at me. I'm finished." George tries to speak. He utters a consolatory bleat. "Unless," he says. "Unless, George. What do you think? I've sent my boy Rafe to Westminster. What will he do there?" But he is crying again. The ghosts are gathering. He feels cold. His position is irretrievable. In Italy, he learned a memory system, so he can remember everything, every stage of how he got here. "I think," he says, "I should go after him."
"Please," says Cavendish, "not before dinner."
"No?"
"Because we need to think how to pay off my lord's servants."
A moment passes. He unfolds the prayer book to himself. He holds it in his arms. Cavendish has given him what he needs, an accountancy problem. "George," he says, "you know my lord's chaplains have flocked here after him, all of them earning, what, £100, £200 a year, out of his liberality? So I think we will make the chaplains and the priests pay off the household servants, because what I think is, what I notice is, that his servants love my lord more than his priests do. So, now let's go to dinner, and after dinner I will make the priests ashamed, and I will make them open their veins and bleed money. We need to give the household a quarter's wages at least, and a retainer, against the day of my lord's restoration."
"Well," says George, "if anyone can do it, you can."
He finds himself smiling. Perhaps it's a grim smile, but he never thought he would smile today. He says, "When that's done, I shall leave you. I shall be back as soon as I have made sure of a place in the Parliament."
"But it meets in 2 days. How will you manage it now?"
"I don't know. But someone must speak for my lord, or they will kill him." He sees the hurt and shock. He wants to take the words back, but it is true. He says, "I can only try. I'll make or mar before I see you again." George almost bows.
"Make or mar," he murmurs. "It was ever your common saying?"
Cavendish walks about the household, saying, "Thomas Cromwell was reading a prayer book. Thomas Cromwell was crying. Only now does George realise how bad things are." Once, in Thessaly, there was a poet called Simonides. He was commissioned to appear at a banquet, given by a man called Scopas, and recite a lyric in praise of his host. Poets have strange vagaries, and in his lyric Simonides incorporated verses in praise of Castor and Pollux, the heavenly twins. Scopas was sulky, and said he would pay only half the fee. "As for the rest, get it from the twins." A little later, a servant came into the hall. He whispered to Simonides. There were 2 young men outside, asking for him by name. He rose and left the banqueting hall. He looked around for the 2 young men, but he could see no one. As he turned back to go and finish his dinner, he heard a terrible noise of stone splitting and crumbling. He heard the cries of the dying as the roof of the hall collapsed. Of all the diners, he was the only one left alive. The bodies were so broken and disfigured that the relatives of the dead could not identify them. But Simonides was a remarkable man. Whatever he saw was imprinted on his mind. He led each of the relatives through the ruins, and pointing to the crushed remains, he said, There is your man. In linking the dead to their names, he worked from the seating plan in his head. It is Cicero who tells us this story. He tells us how, on that day, Simonides invented the art of memory. He remembered the names, the faces, some sour and bloated, some blithe, some bored. He remembered exactly where everyone was sitting at the moment the roof fell in. Part 3, Chapter 1, Three-Card Trick, Winter 1529 to Spring 1530. Joanne. You say, Rafe, go and find me a seat in the new Parliament. And off he goes, like a girl who's been told to bring the washing in. It was harder than that, Rafe says. Joanne says, how would you know? Seats in the Commons are largely in the gift of lords, bishops, the king himself. A scanty handful of electors, if pressured from above, usually do as they're told. Rafe has got him Taunton. It's Wolsey terrain. They wouldn't have let him in if the king had not said yes, if Thomas Howard had not said yes. He had sent Rafe to London to scout the uncertain territory of the Duke's intentions, to find out what lies behind that ferrety grin. Am obliged, master. Now he knows. The Duke of Norfolk, Rafe says, believes my Lord Cardinal has buried treasure, and he thinks you know where it is. They talk alone. Rafe. He'll ask you to go and work for him.
Yes. Perhaps not in so many words.
He watches Rafe's face as he weighs up the situation.
Norfolk is already, unless you count the king's bastard son, the realm's premier nobleman.
I assured him, Rafe says, of your respect, your reverence, your desire to be at his,
commandment,
more or less.
And what did he say?
He said,
He laughs. And was that his tone?
It was his tone.
And his grim nod?
Yes.
Very well. I dry my tears, those tears from All Hallows' Day. I sit with the Cardinal by the fire at Esher, in a room with a smoking chimney. I say, my lord, do you think I would forsake you? I locate the man in charge of chimneys and hearths. I give him orders. I ride to London, to Blackfriars. The day is foggy. St. Hubert's Day. Norfolk is waiting, to tell me he will be a good lord to me. The Duke is now approaching 60 years old, but concedes nothing to the calendar. Flint-faced and keen-eyed, he is lean as a gnawed bone and as cold as an axe head. His joints seem knitted together of supple chain links, and indeed he rattles a little as he moves, for his clothes conceal relics. In tiny jeweled cases, he has shavings of skin and snippets of hair, and set into medallions he wears splinters of martyrs' bones. Marry, he says for an oath, and by the mass.
And sometimes he takes out one of his medals or charms from wherever it is hung about his person and kisses it in a fervour, calling on some saint or martyr to stop his current rage getting the better of him.
St. Jude, give me patience, he will shout.
Probably he has mixed him up with Job, whom he heard about in a story when he was a little boy at the knee of his first priest. It's hard to imagine the Duke as a little boy, or in any way younger or different from the self he presents now. He thinks the Bible a book unnecessary for laypeople, though he understands priests make some use of it. He thinks book reading an affectation altogether, and wishes there were less of it at court. His niece is always reading, Anne Boleyn, which is perhaps why she is unmarried at the age of 28. He does not see why it's a gentleman's business to write letters. There are clerks for that. Now he fixes an eye red and fiery.
Cromwell, I am content you are a burgess in the Parliament.
He bows his head.
My lord. I spoke to the king for you, and he is also content. You will take his instructions in the Commons, and mine.
Will they be the same, my lord? The Duke scowls. He paces. He rattles a little. At last he bursts out.
Damn it all, Cromwell, why are you such a person? It isn't as if you could afford to be.
He waits, smiling. He knows what the Duke means. He is a person. He is a presence. He knows how to edge blackly into a room so that you don't see him. But perhaps those days are over.
Smile away, says the Duke. Wolsey's household is a nest of vipers, not that...
He touches a medal, flinching.
God forbid I should...
Compare a prince of the church to a serpent. The Duke wants the Cardinal's money, and he wants the Cardinal's place at the King's side. But then again, he doesn't want to burn in hell. He walks across the room. He slaps his hands together. He rubs them. He turns.
The King is preparing to quarrel with you, Master. Oh, yes. He will favour you with an interview because he wishes to understand the Cardinal's affairs. But he has, you will learn, a very long and exact memory. And what he remembers, Master, is when you were a burgess of the Parliament before this, and how you spoke against his war.
I hope he doesn't think still of invading France.
God damn you! What Englishman does not? We own France. We have to take back our own.
A muscle in his cheek jumps. He paces, agitated. He turns. He rubs his cheek. The twitch stops. And he says in a voice perfectly matter-of-fact,
Mind you, you're right.
He waits.
We can't win, the Duke says, but we have to fight as if we can. Hang the expense, hang the waste, money, men, horses, ships. That's what's wrong with Wolsey, you see, always at the treaty table. How can a butcher's son understand La Guerre? Are you a butcher's son?
A blacksmith's.
Are you really? Shoe a horse?
He shrugs. If I were put to it, my lord, but I can't imagine...
You can't. What can you imagine? A battlefield? A camp? The night before a battle? Can you imagine that?
I was a soldier myself.
Were you so? Not in any English army, I'll be bound. There, you see.
The Duke grins, quite without animosity.
I knew there was something about you. I knew I didn't like you, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Where were you?
Garigliano.
With?
The French. The Duke whistles.
Wrong side, lad.
So I noticed.
With the French, he chuckles. With the French. And how did you scramble out of that disaster?
I went north. Got into... He's going to say money. But the Duke wouldn't understand trading in money. Cloth, he says. Silk, mostly. You know what the market is with the soldier over there?
By the mass, yes. Johnny Freelance, he puts his money on his back. Those Switzers. Like a troop of play actors. Lace, stripes, fancy hat. Easy target, that's all. Longbowman.
Now and then, he smiles. On the short side for that.
Me too. Now, Henry draws a bow. Very nice. Got the height for it. Got the arm. Still... We won't win many battles like that anymore.
Then how about not fighting any? Negotiate, my lord. It's cheaper.
I tell you, Cromwell, you've got face coming here.
My lord, you sent for me.
Did I?
Norfolk looks alarmed.
It's come to that.
The king's advisers are preparing no fewer than 44 charges against the cardinal. They range from the violation of the statutes of praemunire. That is to say, the upholding of a foreign jurisdiction within the king's realm, to buying beef for his household at the same price as the king, from financial malfeasance to failing to halt the spread of Lutheran heresies. The law of praemunire dates from another century. No one who is alive now quite knows what it means. From day to day it seems to mean what the king says it means. The matter is argued in every talking shop in Europe. Meanwhile, my Lord Cardinal sits,
and sometimes mutters to himself, and sometimes speaks aloud, saying, "Thomas, my colleges! Whatever happens to my person, my colleges must be saved. Go to the king. Whatever vengeance, for whatever imagined injury he would like to wreak on me, he surely cannot mean to put out the light of learning."
In exile at Isha, the cardinal paces and frets. The great mind which once revolved the affairs of Europe now cogitates ceaselessly on its own losses. He lapses into silent inactivity, brooding as the light fails. "For God's sake, Thomas," Cavendish begs him, "don't tell him you're coming if you're not." "I won't," he says, "and I am coming, but sometimes I am held up." The House sits late, and before I leave Westminster, I have to gather up the letters and petitions to my Lord Cardinal, and talk with all the people who want to send messages, but don't want them put into writing. "I understand," Cavendish says, "but Thomas," he wails, "you can't imagine what it's like here at Isha." "What time is it?" my Lord Cardinal says. "What time will Cromwell be here?" And in an hour, again, "Cavendish, what time is it?" He has us out with lights and reporting on the weather, as if you, Cromwell, were a person to be impeded by hailstorms or ice. Then next he will ask, "What if he has met with some accident on the road? The road from London is full of robbers, wasteland and heathland, as the light fails, a creeping with the agents of malefice." From that he will pass on to say, "This world is full of snares and delusions, and into many of them I have fallen, miserable sinner that I am." When he, Cromwell, finally throws off his riding cloak and collapses into a chair by the fire, God's blood, that smoking chimney! The cardinal is at him before he can draw breath. "What said my lord of Suffolk? How looked my lord of Norfolk? The king, have you seen him? Did he speak to you? And Lady Anne, is she in health and good looks? Have you worked any device to please her? Because we must please her, you know." He says, "There is one short way to please that lady, and that is to crown her queen." He closes his lips on the topic of Anne and has no more to say. Mary Boleyn says she has noticed him, but till recently Anne gave no sign of it. Her eyes passed over him on their way to someone who interested her more. They are black eyes, slightly protuberant, shiny like the beads of an abacus. They are shiny and always in motion, as she makes calculations of her own advantage. But Uncle Norfolk must have said to her, "There goes the man who knows the cardinal's secrets." Because now, when he comes into her sight, her long neck darts, those shining black beads go click, click, as she looks him up and down and decides what use can be got out of him. He supposes she is in health, as the year creeps towards its end, not coughing like a sick horse, for instance, nor gone lame. He supposes she is in good looks, if that's what you like. One night, just before Christmas, he arrives late at Isha, and the cardinal is sitting alone, listening to a boy play the lute. He says, "Mark, thank you, go now." The boy bows to the cardinal. He favours him barely with the nod suitable for a burgess in the Parliament. As he withdraws from the room, the cardinal says, "Mark is very adept and a pleasant boy. At York Place he was one of my choristers. I think I shouldn't keep him here, but send him to the king, or to Lady Anne, perhaps, as he is such a pretty young thing. Would she like him?" The boy has lingered at the door to drink in his praises. A hard Cromwellian stare, the equivalent of a kick, sends him out. He wishes people would not ask him what the Lady Anne would and would not like. The cardinal says, "Does Lord Chancellor Moore send me any message?" He drops a sheaf of papers on the table. "You look ill, my lord." "Yes, I am ill. Thomas, what shall we do?" "We shall bribe people," he says. "We shall be liberal and open-handed with the assets your grace has left. For you still have benefices to dispose of. You still have land. Listen, my lord. Even if the king takes all you have, people will be asking, can the king truly bestow what belongs to the cardinal? No one to whom he makes a grant will be sure in their title unless you confirm it. So you still have, my lord.
You still have cards in your hand.
And after all, if he meant to bring a treason...
His voice falters.
If
he meant to charge you with treason, you would be in the tower by now.
Indeed. And what use would I be to him? Head in one place, body in another? This is how it is. The king thinks, by degrading me, to give a sharp lesson to the Pope. He thinks to indicate I, as King of England, am master in my own house. Oh, but is he? Or is Lady Anne master, or Thomas Boleyn? A question not to be asked, not outside this room.
The battle is now to get the king alone, to find out his intentions, if he knows them himself, and broker a deal. The cardinal urgently needs ready cash. That's the first skirmish. Day after day, he waits for an interview. The king extends a hand, takes from him what letters he proffers, glancing at the cardinal's seal. He does not look at him, saying merely an absent, "Thanks." One day, he does look at him and says,
"Master Cromwell, yes, I cannot talk about the cardinal."
And as he opens his mouth to speak, the king says,
"Don't you understand? I cannot talk about him."
His tone is gentle, puzzled.
"Another day," he says. "I will send for you, I promise."
When the cardinal asks him, "How did the king look today?" he says, "He looks as if he does not sleep." The cardinal laughs.
"If he does not sleep, it is because he does not hunt. The icy ground is too hard for the hounds' pads. They cannot go out. It is lack of fresh air, Thomas. It is not his conscience."
Later, he will remember that night towards the end of December, when he found the cardinal listening to music. He will run it through his mind twice and over again. Because as he's leaving the cardinal and contemplating again the road, the night, he hears a boy's voice speaking behind a half-open door. It is Mark, the lute player.
"So, for my skill, he says he will prefer me to Lady Anne, and I shall be glad, because what is the use of being here when any day the king may behead the old fellow? I think he ought, for the cardinal is so proud. Today is the first day he ever gave me a good word."
A pause. Someone speaks, muffled. He cannot tell who. Then the boy.
"Yes, for sure the lawyer will come down with him." "I say lawyer, but who is he? Nobody knows. They say he has killed men with his own hands, and never told it in confession. But those hard kinds of men, they always weep when they see the hangman."
He is in no doubt that it is his own execution Mark looks forward to. Beyond the wall, the boy runs on.
"So when I am with Lady Anne, she is sure to notice me and give me presents."
A giggle.
"And look on me with favour, don't you think? Who knows where she may turn while she is still refusing the king?"
A pause. Then Mark.
"She is no maid, not she."
What an enchanting conversation, servant's talk. Again comes a muffled answer, and then Mark.
"Could she be at the French court, do you think, and come home a maid, any more than her sister could? And Mary was every man's hackney."
But this is nothing. He's disappointed. "I had hopes of particulars, and this is just the on dit." But still he hesitates and doesn't move away.
"Besides, Tom Wyatt has had her, and everybody knows it down in Kent. I have been down to Penshurst with the cardinal, and you know that palace is near to Hever, where the lady's family is, and the Wyatt's house an easy ride away."
Witnesses? Dates? But then, from the unseen person, "Shh!" Again, a soft giggle. One can do nothing with this, except bear it in mind. The conversation is in Flemish, language of Mark's birthplace. Christmas comes, and the king, with Queen Catherine, keeps it at Greenwich. Anne is at York Place. The king can come upriver to see her.
Her company, the women say, is exacting. The king's visits are short, few, and discreet. At Isha, the cardinal takes to his bed. Once he would never have done that, though he looks ill enough to justify it. He says, "Nothing will happen while the king and Lady Anne are exchanging their New Year kisses. We are safe from incursions till Twelfth Night." He turns his head against his pillows, says vehement, "Body of Christ, Cromwell, go home." The house at the Austin Friars is decorated with wreaths of holly and ivy, of laurel and ribboned yew. The kitchen is busy, feeding the living, but they omit this year their usual songs and Christmas plays. No year has brought such devastation. His sister, Kat, her husband, Morgan Williams, have been plucked from this life as fast as his daughters were taken. One day walking and talking, the next day cold as stones, tumbled into their Thameside graves, and dug in beyond reach of the tide, beyond sight and smell of the river. Deaf now to the sound of Putney's cracked church bell, to the smell of wet ink, of hops, of malted barley, and the scent, still animal, of woolen bales. Dead to the autumn aroma of pine resin and apple candles, of soul cakes, baking. As the year ends, two orphans are added to this house, Richard and the child, Walter. Morgan Williams, he was a big talker, but he was shrewd in his own way, and he worked hard for his family. And Kat, well, latterly she understood her brother about as well as she understood the motions of the stars. "I can never add you up, Thomas," she'd say, which was his failure entirely, because who had taught her, except him, to count on her fingers and puzzle out a tradesman's bill? If he were to give himself a piece of advice for Christmas, he'd say, "Leave the cardinal now, or you'll be out on the streets again with a three-card trick." But he only gives advice to those who are likely to take it. They have a big gilded star at the Austin Friars, which they hang in the great hall on New Year's Eve. For a week it shines out to welcome their guests to Epiphany. From summer onwards, he and Liz will be thinking of costumes for the three kings, coveting and hoarding scraps of any strange cloth they saw, any new trimmings. Then, from October, Liz will be sewing in secrecy, improving on last year's robes by patching them over with new shining panels, quilting a shoulder and weighting a hem, and building each year some fantastical new crowns. His part was to think what the gifts would be that the kings had in their boxes. Once a king had dropped his casket in shock when the gift began to sing. This year, no one has the heart to hang up the star, but he visits it in its lightless storeroom. He slides off the canvas sleeves that protect its rays and checks that they are unchipped and unfaded. There will be better years when they will hang it up again, though he cannot imagine them. He eases back the sleeves, pleased at how ingeniously they've been made and how exactly they fit. The three kings' robes are packed into a chest, as also the sheepskins for the children who will be sheep. The shepherd's crooks lean in a corner. From a peg hang angels' wings. He touches them. His finger comes away dusty. He shifts his candle out of danger, then lifts them from the peg and gently shakes them. They make a soft sound of hissing, and a faint amber perfume washes into the air. He hangs them back on the peg, passes over them the palm of his hand, to soothe them, and still they shiver. He picks up his candle. He backs out and closes the door. He pinches out the light, turns the lock, and gives the key to Joanne. He says to her, "I wish we had a baby. It seems such a long time since there was a baby in the house." "Don't look at me," Joanne says. He does, of course. He says, "Does John Williamson not do his duty by you these days?" She says, "His duty is not my pleasure." As he walks away, he thinks, "That's a conversation I shouldn't have had." On New Year's Day, when night falls, he is sitting at his writing table. He is writing letters for the cardinal, Sometimes he crosses the room to his counting board and pushes the counters about. It seems that in return for a formal guilty plea to the praemunire charges, the king will allow the cardinal his life and a measure of liberty. But whatever money is left him to maintain his state will be a fraction of his former income. York Place has been taken already. Hampton Court is long gone, and the king is thinking of how to tax and rob the rich bishopric of Winchester. Gregory comes in.
I brought you lights. My Aunt Joanne said go into your father.
Gregory sits. He waits. He fidgets. He sighs. He gets up. He crosses to his father's writing table and hovers in front of him. Then, as if someone had said, make yourself useful, he reaches out timidly and begins to tidy the papers. He glances up at his son while keeping his head down over his task. For the first time, perhaps, since Gregory was a baby, he notices his hands, and he's struck by what they have become. Not childish paws, but the large, white, untroubled hands of a gentleman's son. What is Gregory doing? He's putting the documents into a stack. On what principle is he doing it? He can't read them. They're the wrong way up. He's not filing them by subject. Is he filing them by date? For God's sake, what is he doing? He needs to finish this sentence with its many vital subclauses. He glances up again and recognizes Gregory's design. It is a system of holy simplicity. Big papers on the bottom, small ones on top. Father, Gregory says. He sighs. He crosses to the counting board. With a forefinger, he inches the counters about. Then he scoops them together, picks them up, and clicks them into a tidy pile. He looks up at last. That was a calculation. It wasn't just where I dropped them. Oh, sorry, Gregory says politely. He sits down by the fire and tries not to disturb the air as he breathes. The mildest eyes can be commanding. Under his son's gaze, he asks, what is it?
Do you think you can stop writing?
A minute, he says, holding up a delaying hand. He signs the letter, his usual form. Your assured friend, Thomas Cromwell. If Gregory is going to tell him that someone else in the house is mortally ill, or that he, Gregory, has offered himself in marriage to the laundry girl, or that London Bridge has fallen down, he must be ready to take it like a man. But he must sand and seal this. He looks up.
Yes?
Gregory turns his face away. Is he crying? It would not be surprising, would it? As he has cried himself and in public. He crosses the room. He sits down opposite his son by the hearth. He takes off his cap of velvet and runs his hands back through his hair. For a long time, no one speaks. He looks down at his own thick-fingered hands, scars and burn marks hidden in the palms. He thinks, gentlemen, so you call yourself. But who do you hope to mislead? Only the people who've never seen you, or the people you keep distance with courtesy, legal clients and your fellows in the commons, colleagues at Gray's Inn, the household servants of courtiers, the courtiers themselves. His mind strays to the next letter he must write. Then Gregory says, his voice small, as if he had receded into the past, do you remember that Christmas, when there was the giant in the pageant?
Here in the parish?
I remember.
He said, I am a giant. My name is Marlin Spike.
They said he was as tall as the Cornhill Maypole.
What's the Cornhill Maypole?
They took it down. The year of the riots. Evil May Day, they called it. You were only a baby then.
Where's the Maypole now?
The city has it in store.
Shall we have our star again next year?
If our fortunes look up.
Shall we be poor now the cardinal is down?
No. The little flames leap and flare, and Gregory looks into them.
You remember the year I had my face dyed black, and I was wrapped in a black calfskin, when I was a devil in the Christmas play?
I do. His face softens. I remember. Anne had wanted to be dyed, but her mother had said it was not suitable for a little girl. He wishes he had said that Anne must have her turn as a parish angel, even if, being dark, she had to wear one of the parish's yellow knitted wigs, which slipped sideways or fell over the children's eyes. The year that Grace was an angel, she had wings made of peacock feathers. He himself had contrived it. The other little girls were dowdy goose creatures, and their wings fell off if they caught them on the corners of the stable. But Grace stood glittering, her hair entwined with silver threads. Her shoulders were trussed with a spreading, shivering glory, and the rustling air was perfumed as she breathed. Lizzie said, "Thomas, there's no end to you, is there? She has the best wings the city has ever seen." Gregory stands up. He comes to kiss him good night. For a moment his son leans against him, as if he were a child, or as if the past, the pictures in the fire, were an intoxication. Once the boy has gone to bed, he sweeps his papers out of the tidy stack he has made. He refolds them. He sorts them with the endorsement out, ready for filing. He thinks of evil May Day. Gregory did not ask, why were there riots? The riots were against foreigners. He himself had not long been home. As 1530 begins, he does not hold an Epiphany feast, because so many people, sensible of the cardinal's disgrace, would be obliged to refuse his invitation. Instead, he takes the young men to Gray's Inn for the Twelfth Night revels. He regrets it almost at once. This year they are noisier and more bawdy than any he remembers. The law students make a play about the cardinal. They make him flee from his palace at York Place to his barge on the Thames. Some fellows flap dyed sheets to impersonate the river, and then others run up and throw water on them from leather buckets. As the cardinal scrambles into his barge, there are hunting cries, and one benighted fool runs into the hall with a brace of otter hounds on a leash. Others come with nets and fishing rods to haul the cardinal back to the bank. The next scene shows the cardinal floundering in the mud at Putney as he runs to his bolt hole at Esher. The students halloo and cry as the cardinal weeps and holds up his hands in prayer. Of all the people who witness this, who, he wonders, has offered it up as a comedy? If he knew, or if he guessed, the worse for them. The cardinal lies on his back, a crimson mountain. He flails his hands. He offers his bishopric of Winchester to anyone who can get him back on his mule. Some students, under a frame draped with donkey skins, enact the mule, which turns about and jokes in Latin and farts in the cardinal's face. There is much wordplay about bishoprics and bishop's pricks, which might pass as witty if they were street sweepers, but he thinks law students should do better. He rises from his place, displeased, and his household has no choice but to stand up with him and walk out. He stops to have a word with some of the benchers. How is this allowed to go forward? The Cardinal of York is a sick man. He may die. How will you and your students stand then before your God? What sort of young man are you breeding here, who are so brave as to assail a great man who has fallen on evil times, whose favour, a few short weeks ago, they would have begged for? The benchers follow him, apologising, but their voices are lost in the roars of laughter that billow out from the hall. His young household are lingering, casting glances back. The cardinal is offering his harem of 40 virgins to anyone who will help him mount. He sits on the ground and laments, while a flaccid and serpentine member, knitted of red wool, flops out from under his robes. Outside, lights burn thin in the icy air. "Home," he says. He hears Gregory whisper, "We can only laugh if he permits us." "Well, after all," he hears Rafe say, "he is the man in charge." He falls back a step to speak with them. "Anyway, It was the wicked Borgia Pope, Alexander, who kept 40 women. And none of them were virgins, I can tell you. Rafe touches his shoulder. Richard walks on his left, sticking close. You don't have to hold me up, he says mildly. I'm not like the cardinal. He stops. He laughs. He says, I suppose it was... Yes, it was quite entertaining, Richard says. His grace must have been 5 feet around his waist. The night is loud with the noise of bone rattles and alive with the flames of torches. A troop of hobby horses clatters past them, singing, and a party of men wearing antlers with bells at their heels. As they near home, a boy dressed as an orange rolls past, with his friend, a lemon. Gregory Cromwell, they call out. And to him, as their senior, they courteously raise, in lieu of hats, an upper slice of rind. God send you a good new year. The same to you, he calls, and to the lemon. Tell your father to come and see me about the Cheapside lease. They get home. Go to bed, he says. It's late. He feels it best to add, God see you safe till morning. They leave him. He sits at his work table. He remembers Grace at the end of her evening as an angel, standing in the firelight, her face white with fatigue, her eyes glittering, and the eyes of her peacock's wings shining in the firelight, each like a topaz, golden, smoky. Liz said, Stand away from the fire, sweetheart, or your wings will catch a light. His little girl backed off into shadow. The feathers were the colours of ash and cinders as she moved towards the stairs, and he said, Grace, are you going to bed in your wings?
Till I say my prayers, she said, darting a look over her shoulder.
He followed her, afraid for her, afraid of fire and some other danger, but he did not know what. She walked up the staircase, her plumes rustling, her feathers fading to black. Ah, Christ, he thinks. At least I'll never have to give her to anyone else. She's dead, and I'll not have to sign her away to some purse-mouthed petty gent who wants her dowry. Grace would have wanted a title. She would have thought, because she was lovely, he should buy her one. Lady Grace. I wish my daughter Anne were here, he thinks. I wish Anne were here, and promised to Rafe Sadler. If Anne were older... If Rafe were younger, if Anne were still alive. Once more he bends his head over the cardinal's letters. Wolsey is writing to the rulers of Europe to ask them to support him, vindicate him, fight his cause. He, Thomas Cromwell, wishes the cardinal would not, or if he must, could the encryption be more tricky? Is it not treasonable for Wolsey to urge them to obstruct the king's purpose? Henry would deem it is. The cardinal is not asking them to make war on Henry on his behalf. He's merely asking them to withdraw their approval of a king who very much likes to be liked. He sits back in his chair, hands over his mouth, as if to disguise his opinion from himself. He thinks, I am glad I love my Lord Cardinal, because if I did not, and I were his enemy... Let us say I am Suffolk, let us say I am Norfolk, let us say I am the king. I will be putting him on trial next week. The door opens. Richard, you can't sleep. Well, I knew it. The play was too exciting for you. It is easy to smile now, but Richard does not smile. His face is in shadow. He says, Master, I have a question to put to you. Our father is dead, and you are our father now. Richard Williams, and Walter named after Walter Williams, these are his sons. Sit down, he says.
So, shall we change our name to yours?
You surprise me. The way things are with me, the people called Cromwell will be wanting to change their names to Williams.
If I had your name... I should never disown it.
Would your father like it?
You know, he believed he had his descent from Welsh princes. Ah, he did. When he'd had a drink, he would say, "Who will give me a shilling for my principality?"
"Even so, you have the Tudor name in your descent, by some accounts."
"Don't," Richard pleads. "It makes beads of blood stand out on my forehead."
"It's not that hard," he laughs. "Listen, the old king had an uncle, Jasper Tudor. Jasper had two bastard daughters, Joan and Helen. Helen was Gardiner's mother. Joan married William ap Evan. She was your grandmother."
"Is that all? Why did my father make it sound so deep? But if I am the king's cousin..." Richard pauses. "And Stephen Gardiner's cousin, what good can it do me? We're not at court, and not likely to be, now the cardinal..." "Well..." He looks away. "Sir, when you were on your travels, did you ever think you would die?"
"Yes. Oh, yes." Richard looks at him.
"How did that feel?"
"I felt," he said, "irritated. It seemed a waste, I suppose, to come so far, to cross the sea, to die for..." He shrugs. "God knows why."
Richard says, "Every day I light a candle for my father."
"Does that help you?"
"No, I just do it."
"Does he know you do it?"
"I can't imagine what he knows. I know the living must comfort each other."
"This comforts me, Richard Cromwell."
Richard gets up, kisses his cheek. "Good night. Cuscandowl."
"Sleep well." It is the familiar form for those who are close to home. It is the usage for fathers, for brothers. It matters what name we choose, what name we make. The people lose their name who lie dead on the field of battle, the ordinary corpses of no lineage, with no herald to search for them, and no chantry, no perpetual prayers. Morgan's bloodline won't be lost, he's sure of it, though he died in a busy year for death, when London was never out of black. He touches his throat, where the medal would have been, the holy medal that Cat gave him. His fingers are surprised not to find it there. For the first time he understands why he took it off and slid it into the sea. It was so that no living hand could take it. The waves took it, and the waves have it still. The chimney at Esher continues to smoke. He goes to the Duke of Norfolk, who is always ready to see him, and asks him what is to be done about the Cardinal's household. In this matter, both dukes are helpful. "Nothing is more malcontent," says Norfolk, "than a masterless man. Nothing more dangerous. Whatever one thinks of the Cardinal of York, he was always well served. Prefer them to me. Send them in my direction. They will be my men." He directs a searching look at Cromwell, who turns away, knows himself coveted, wears an expression like an heiress, sly, coy, cold. He's arranging a loan for the Duke. His foreign contacts are less than excited. "The Cardinal down," he says, "the Duke has risen like the morning sun, and sitteth at Henry's right hand." "Tommaso," they say, "seriously, you are offering what as guarantee?" "Some old duke who may be dead tomorrow. They say he is choleric. You are offering a dukedom security in that barbaric island of yours, which is always breaking out into civil war, and another war coming, if your willful king will set aside the emperor's aunt and install his whore as queen. Still, he'll get terms somewhere." Charles Brandon says, "You here again, Master Cromwell, with your lists of names. Is there anyone you specially recommend to me?" "Yes, but I'm afraid he's a man of a lowly stamp, and more fit that I should confer with your kitchen steward." "No, tell me," says the Duke. He can't bear suspense. "It's only the hearths and chimneys man. Hardly a matter for your grace." "I'll have him, I'll have him," Charles Brandon says. "I like a good fire." Thomas More, The Lord Chancellor has put his signature first on all the articles against Wolsey. They say one strange allegation has been added at his behest. The Cardinal is accused of whispering in the King's ear and breathing into his face. Since the Cardinal has the French pox, he intended to infect our monarch. When he hears this, he thinks, imagine living inside the Lord Chancellor's head. Imagine writing down such a charge and taking it to the printer and circulating it through the court and through the realm, putting it out there to where people will believe anything, putting it out there to the shepherds on the hills, to Tyndale's ploughboy, to the beggar on the roads, and the patient beast in its byre or stall, out there to the bitter winter winds and to the weak early sun and the snowdrops in the London gardens. It is a wan morning, low unbroken cloud. The light, filtering sparely through glass, is the colour of tarnished pewter. How brightly coloured the king is, like the king in a new pack of cards. How small his flat blue eye. There is a crowd of gentlemen around Henry Tudor. They ignore his approach. Only Harry Norris smiles, gives him a polite good morning. At a signal from the king, the gentlemen retire to a distance, bright in their riding cloaks. It is a hunting morning. They flutter, eddy, cluster. They whisper one to the other and conduct a discourse in nods and shrugs. The king glances out of the window. So, he says, how is... He seems reluctant to name the cardinal. He cannot be well till he has your majesty's favour. 44 charges, the king says. 44, master. Saving your majesty, there is an answer to each one, and given a hearing, we would make them. Could you make them here and now? If your majesty would care to sit. I heard you were a ready man. Would I come here unprepared? He has spoken almost without thinking. The king smiles, that fine curl of the red lip. He has a pretty mouth, almost like a woman's. It is too small for his face. Another day I'd put you to the test, he says. But my Lord Suffolk is waiting for me. Would the cloud lift, do you think? I wish I'd gone out before Mass. I think it will be clear, he says. A good day to be chasing something. Master Cromwell... The king turns, he looks at him astonished. You are not of Thomas More's opinion, are you? He waits. He cannot imagine what the king is going to say. La chasse. He thinks it barbaric. Oh, I see. No, your majesty, I favour any sport that's cheaper than battle. It's rather that... How can he put it? In some countries they hunt the bear, and the wolf, and the wild boar. We once had these animals in England, when we had our great forests. My cousin France has bought a hunt. From time to time he says he will ship me some, but I feel... You feel he is taunting you. We usually say... Henry looks straight at him. We usually say, we gentlemen, that the chase prepares us for war, which brings us to a sticky point, Master Cromwell. It does indeed, he says, cheerful. You said in the Parliament some 6 years ago that I could not afford a war. It was 7 years, 1523. And how long has this audience lasted? 7 minutes? 7 minutes, and he is sure already. There's no point backing off. Do that, and Henry will chase you down. Advance, and he may just falter. He says... No ruler in the history of the world has ever been able to afford a war. They're not affordable things. No prince ever says, this is my budget, so this is the kind of war I can have. You enter into one, and it uses up all the money you've got, and then it breaks you and bankrupts you. When I went into France in the year 1513, I captured the town of Terouin, which in your speech you called... A dog-hole, Majesty. A dog-hole, the king repeats. How could you say so? He shrugs. I've been there. A flash of anger. And so have I. at the head of my army. Listen to me, master. You said I should not fight because the taxes would break the country. What is the country for but to support its prince in his enterprise? I believe, I said, saving your majesty, we didn't have the gold to see you through a year's campaign, or the bullion in the country would be swallowed by the war. I have read there was a time when people exchanged leather tokens for want of metal coins. I said we would be back to those days. You said I was not to lead my troops. You said if I was taken, the country couldn't put up the ransom. So what do you want? You want a king who doesn't fight? You want me to huddle indoors like a sick girl? That would be ideal, for fiscal purposes. The king takes a deep, ragged breath. He's been shouting. Now, and it's a narrow thing, he decides to laugh. You advocate prudence. Prudence is a virtue. But there are other virtues that belong to princes. Fortitude. Yes, cost that out. It doesn't mean courage in battle. Do you read me a lesson? It means fixity of purpose. It means endurance. It means having the strength to live with what constrains you. Henry crosses the room, stamp, 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 in his riding boots. He is ready for la chasse. He turns, rather slowly, to show his majesty to better effect, wide and square and bright. We will pursue this. What constrains me? The distance, he says. The harbours, the terrain, the people, the winter rains and the mud. When your majesty's ancestors fought in France, whole provinces were held by England. From there we could supply, we could provision. Now that we have only Calais, how can we support an army in the interior? The king stares out into the silver morning. He bites his lip. Is he in a slow fury, simmering, bubbling to boiling point? He turns and his smile is sunny. I know, he says. So when we next go into France, we will need a sea coast. Of course. We need to take Normandy or Brittany, that's all. Well reasoned, the king says. I bear you no ill will. Only I suppose you have no experience in policy or the direction of a campaign. He shakes his head. None. You said, before I mean, in the speech of yours to the Parliament, that there was £1 million in gold in the realm. I gave a round figure. But how would you find that figure? I trained in the Florentine banks and in Venice. The king stares at him. Howard said you were a common soldier. That too. Anything else? What would your majesty like me to be? The king looks him full in the face. A rare thing with him. He looks back. It is his habit. Master Cromwell, your reputation is bad. He inclines his head. You don't defend yourself. Your Majesty is able to form his own opinion. I can. I will. At the door, the guards part their spears. The gentlemen step aside and bow. Suffolk pounds in, Charles Brandon. He looks too hot in his clothes. You ready? He says to the king. Oh, Cromwell, he grins. How's your fat priest? The king flushes with displeasure. Brandon doesn't notice. You know, he chuckles, they say the cardinal once rode out with his servant and checked his horse at the head of a valley, where looking down he saw a very fair church and its lands about. He says to his servant, Robin, who owns that? I would that were my benefice. Robin says, it is, my lord, it is. His story meets with poor success. But he laughs at it himself. He says, My lord, they tell that story all over Italy, of this cardinal or that. Brandon's face falls. What? Same story? Mutatis mutandis. The servant isn't called Robin. The king meets his eye. He smiles.
Leaving, he pushes past the gentleman. And who should he meet but the king's secretary?
"Good morning, good morning," he says.
He doesn't often repeat things, but the moment seems to call for it. Gardiner is rubbing his great blue hands together.
"Cold, no,"
he says.
"And how was that, Cromwell? Unpleasant, I think?"
"On the contrary," he says. "Oh, and he's going out with Suffolk. You'll have to wait." He walks on, but then turns. There is a pain like a dull bruise inside his chest. "Gardiner, can't we drop this?"
"No,"
Gardiner says. His drooping eyelids flicker.
"No, I don't see that we can."
"Fine," he says. He walks on. He thinks, "You wait. You may have to wait a year or two, but you just wait."
This ends disc 6.